and I'm in denial. And it don't take no x-ray to see right through my smile. I know I'll be on the go. And it ain't no drink out there that can numb my soul. Oh no. And all we wanna do is take the chains off. All we wanna do is break the chains off, man. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is take the chains off. All we wanna do is break the chains off, man. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is be free. Can you tell me why? Every time I step outside, I see my niggas die. Kill my soul. Oh no. Say, all we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is take the chains off. All we want to do is break the chains off. All we want to do is be free. All we want to do is be free.
It was like the officer's pulling him inside the car. He's trying to pull away. And at no time, the officer said that he was going to do anything until he pulled out his weapon. His weapon was drawn, and he said, I'll shoot you, or I'm going to shoot. And in the same moment, the first shot went off. And we looked at him. He was shot, and it was blood coming from him. And we took off running.
Are we all alone, fighting on our own? Please give me a chance. I don't wanna dance. Something's got me down. I will stand my ground. Don't just stand around. Don't just stand around.
As we took off running, I ducked and hid for my life because I was fearing for my life. And I hid by the first car that I saw. My friend, he kept running. And he told me to keep running because he feared for me too. So as he was running, the officer was trying to get out of the car. And once he got out the car, he pursued my friend, but his weapon was drawn. Now, he didn't see any weapon drawn at him or anything like that. Us going for no weapon. His weapon was already drawn when he got out the car. He shot again, and once my friend felt that shot, he turned around and he put his hands in the earth, and he started to get down, but the officer still approached with his weapon drawn, and he fired several more shots, and my friend died.
All we wanna do is take the chains off. All we wanna do is break the chains off. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is be free. All we wanna do is take the chains off. All we wanna do is break the chains off.
Good afternoon. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host today, and today we're beginning a new series on KZYX, a series in part honoring February, Black History Month, but this will be about much more than history. We're calling these programs Black Lives Matter, the Police and the People. The programs will involve in-depth looks at the movement that developed at the end of last year, the movement that exploded in reaction to the decisions in the Michael Brown and Eric Garner cases of black men killed by white police and then the police exonerated. These cases hit home here in Mendocino County when members of the Mendocino High School girls basketball team, warming up for an early game, wore I Can't Breathe t-shirts. I Can't Breathe, the last words of the late Eric Garner. The Mendocino girls were then banned from participating in Fort Bragg's annual holiday basketball tournament, and this despite the incredulous response of the media nationwide, even worldwide. It was on the front pages of The Guardian newspaper in London, for example. Well, the ban was reluctantly withdrawn, but the girls, by that time, had been effectively eliminated from the tournament. So today, we'll begin our series with two guests. First, Kira Pellman, a co-captain of the Mendocino High School girls basketball team. Kira is a junior at Mendocino High School. She plays volleyball as well. She is interested in continuing to study in the future environmental sciences. And she likes to cook, and she likes to camp, and she likes to hike. And then our second guest will be Tajiwe Makaris. Tajiwe is campaign director for human rights at home. She has spent her political life in her own terms, her own words, challenging the injustices that imprison people in their communities in lives of poverty and behind bars. She's been active in campaigns from New Orleans, Louisiana, to South Africa, and she now lives in New York City. Hello, Kira Pellman. Great to have you on the station with us today.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. Our pleasure. I think we should get right into this story, Kira, if you don't mind. You and the other girls at Mendocino High School became sort of celebrities, to put it mildly, last month. And so I wondered if you could just tell us a little about the story from your point of view. How did you first get involved in the issue of, let's call it the I Can't Breathe issue that you girls had on your T-shirts? What was the beginning of that?
Yeah, sure. So I guess we first got involved, it was in early December. We had a game against Fort Bragg on December 16th. And so the week before that, one of the varsity boys members actually had the idea to join the NBA members and fellow basketball players from colleges around the nation that had been wearing I Can't Breathe shirts in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. So one of the boys decided that, or asked his team if they would like to wear them, and they decided to do it. And so one of the captains approached me and asked if our team wanted to, and after sending out a message to my teammates, everyone had positive feelings about it, so we decided to join them and then got the shirts, and both us and the boys team wore them. The first time we wore them was coincidentally in Fort Bragg against just the scrimmage that we were having against them.
At the high school in Fort Bragg?
Yeah.
With an audience, Kira?
An audience and refs. It was an official game, but just not a league game.
Ah. And what happened there?
Well, we didn't receive any sort of backlash or even controversy there. Seemingly, the only thing that was even brought up about the shirts that I can recall or to my knowledge was during our captain's meeting, me and my co-captain went up to shake hands with the other captains, and the ref asked me what the shirts were about. And after quickly kind of took me off guard because I wasn't sure if he actually didn't know what they were or if he was just testing us. And after I started talking about Eric Garner and why we were wearing the shirts, he kind of brushed me off as if, he knew what they were about. He just didn't think that we did. And then after that, there wasn't anything said about it.
Kara, sorry, anything said at Mendocino High School about it?
No, nothing. We didn't receive any controversy.
Okay.
Until Mendocino Sports Plus, the local news guy, kind of, posted a story on it. And at that point, we were seeing all these comments that were, super opinionated, either in full support of us or very opposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
But we continued to wear the shirts. We wore them to a tournament in Upper Lake as well as one in Geyserville. And there we only received positive feedback if from other team members, members from other teams. Still no controversy, seemingly. And then it wasn't until Fort Bragg we got a notification from Fort Bragg via our athletic director and principal who came to our practice, who said that we had to either decide to not wear the shirts in the Fort Bragg Holiday Classic or we would be disqualified and not be able to play.
Hmm.
And then that's when we made the decision. The boys decided that they were going to put down their shirts and play, and for us it seemed like an obvious choice that we didn't want to play if we weren't able to express our opinions.
And do you feel like the choice was left to you at the school?
Yeah, as far as the Mendocino administration was really supportive of us, they came to our practice multiple times and said pretty much, it's up to you guys. We'll support you whatever you choose to do. They just asked that we did it in a respectful way, but they said that they were proud of us all the way through.
Okay, and then I guess what happened? The word started to get out.
Yeah, the word started to get out. Originally, it kind of blew up after nothing had really been in national news until after the Associated Press somehow got a hold of the story. And the same article was put in the New York Times and the London Times and all over. And then after that, we started, getting a lot of interest from the media and calling our houses. And it was really overwhelming at first because we didn't know. We obviously, when we put on the shirts, we never expected it to, we wanted to raise consciousness in our communities, but we didn't expect to get such coverage.
Well, say a word about that. You wanted to raise consciousness. You don't have to speak for the whole team. What was your concern about the issue?
I guess it was just after being growing up in Mendocino, we don't have as much exposure to racism and the protests as we would if we grew up in a big city. So having the opportunity to somehow voice our opinions and kind of show that it's a problem that even though we don't have it as severely here, that we still think it's a problem that we need to be the one standing up against it. And so we just kind of decided that as a team it'd be a good opportunity for us. And we did that. And I think for the most part, we did, obviously there was a lot of people that were upset with it, but for the most part, I think that our community was really supportive of us. And if they weren't necessarily supportive of the cause, which most people were, but they were supportive, I think, and proud that just we were finally able to voice our opinions and stand up and say what we believe in.
Well, sure. How did you learn about Eric Garner? Just once again, just your own experience.
I don't know. It was just in the news everywhere. I think it was hard to not know about him,
uh-huh.
Kind of. We talked about it, I guess. We discussed it some in our social sciences classes, but mostly just from, just existing, you kind of know about him.
Okay, good. And so the Fort Bragg School District, I guess, decided that you couldn't play if you were going to have the T-shirts on. What happened then?
We got a note from Rebecca Walker saying that we had been uninvited from the tournament after that because they were scared for our safety, because I guess they thought that they couldn't anticipate what was going to happen if we did wear the shirts. So after that happened, we were all pretty disappointed. And then from there, someone had contacted the ACLU, and they, which was no one on our team, it was a father of one of the boys' players contacted the ACLU, and we didn't hear back from them until the day before the tournament was to start. And so they started to work on Fort Bragg, trying to get in contact with Fort Bragg School District to make it possible for us to be able to play, or at least for us to get a one game in to kind of end things and have, because with our shirts on. So the ACLU and Fort Bragg School District was in communication at this point, and we had also simultaneously been planning a protest to take place outside of Fort Bragg High School wearing our shirts, a protest both for to continue supporting our original cause of the Black Lives Matter campaign and also to protest that our freedom of speech had been oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a protest outside of the Fort Bragg gym that morning, the first morning that the tournament started. And then a group of the protesters, who was made up of community members from Mendocino and Fort Bragg, as well as members of our basketball team, decided to go inside the gym after we had been notified that if you tried to enter the gym with a shirt that had a political statement, you'd be asked to leave. But we decided to kind of test our limits, and we went in there, and there was a security that Fort Bragg had hired, but they just all decided to let us in without any sort of struggle at the door. So I think that was a result of the ACLU and Fort Bragg School District being in contact, and kind of Fort Bragg probably realizing that what they had done was illegal.
Hmm. But you weren't allowed in the end, or you didn't in the end play in the tournament. Is that right?
No, we were never reinstated in to be able to play in the tournament, but we were able to wear our shirts in the gym. But no, we didn't get to play.
Okay. And the story became, I suppose, even more controversial when the sheriff's department got involved. When were you first aware of the interest of the sheriff's department?
I don't remember a date, but I do know that it was soon after the two sheriffs were killed in New York that the Fort Bragg Sheriff's Department posted a link on their Facebook page that was a link to that article, and they had captioned it with something like sad for the loss and that sheriffs need to be respected more, and that they were sad to see that Mendocino High School basketball teams had been wearing shirts that said, "I can't breathe," and that they found that disrespectful and discouraging.
And how did you respond, you meaning the girls?
Well, we constructed a letter because we at first our initial my initial response at least was kind of frustrated that they weren't able to see beyond just our local community, and they couldn't see that obviously police brutality and racism is a national issue, which we were never intending to fight our local community. So me and my co-captain, Jin, got together, and we constructed a letter, and then we sent it out to all the boys and girls and had anyone who would like to sign it.
Okay, and did others sign?
Yeah, there was, I think there was about 15 of us that signed the letter.
And that's this hard question, really, but you must have been a little intimidated. Were you worried about answering the sheriff's department?
We knew that we had to do it in the most respectful way possible, but to us, our cause really wouldn't have gotten anywhere if we had just sat down at this point, or if we weren't able to communicate with them, then I don't think that it would have been nearly as effective.
Right. And do you have a copy of your letter?
Yeah, I do. I have one right here.
Would you mind reading it to us, to the listeners?
Sure.
Read it nice and slowly so that it's an important letter so that everyone can take it in.
Yeah, of course. Okay, let me get it. Okay, so it says, "To the Mendocino County Deputy Sheriff's Association and all concerned citizens, it has come to our attention that the members of the local law enforcement felt discouraged and disrespected by our participation in a nonviolent national protest. We have worn shirts during the warm-ups at recent basketball games that say, 'I can't breathe.' Although the association did not contact us directly, the statements made on its Facebook page regarding the subject states that they interpreted our shirts as a protest to our local sheriffs. Some of us and many of our parents personally knew Deputy Del Florentino. He was the best example of a law enforcement officer who knew how to calm down tense situations peacefully. Our protest has nothing to do with an exemplary officers like Deputy Del Fiorentino. We are saddened that the message we are trying to send has been disconstrued, but understand that by choosing to wear our shirts, we were getting involved in a very real and controversial issue. Eric Garner died after being put in a chokehold by law enforcement officers. His last words during the incident, 'I can't breathe,' had become a slogan that has gained momentum and media attention after members of the NBA as well as entire college and high school basketball teams wore shirts with this slogan during their warm-ups. The Mendocino High School varsity girls and boys basketball teams made the decision to wear the shirts without the initial encouragement of any parent, coach, or other adult. We, the players, wanted to express our support for the people who face prejudices, racism, and police brutality daily in our country, and convey our concern about these injustices to the public. We are fortunate to live in a community in which these types of wrongs are uncommon and respect our local law enforcement officers fully. We appreciate police officers and their difficult and sometimes dangerous job, but at the same time, we condemn police brutality that does exist in our country and feel even small communities like ours should promote awareness of such crucial matters. Respectfully, various members of the Mendocino High School varsity basketball teams." And then the people who signed it were Kira Pellman, Jin Jackson, Scott Duncan, Emily Simons, Michaela Hubbard, Naomi Baker, Isabel Hall, Sean Simons, Connor Woods, Emily Miller, Isaiah Graham, Amy Gordon, and Cypress Beaudoin.
Very good. Well, what's happened since then? I think you told me that you continue to get calls really from all over the place. Is that right?
Yeah, it's been pretty amazing.
Could you give us a couple of examples of?
Yeah, well, so after everything happened, about a week later, we had gotten so much interest from the media and wanted to get our story out, just to further our cause. So me and my co-captain Jen Jackson, and actually Jen got hurt at the beginning of the season, and Emily Simons has replaced her as captain. So the three of us got together. And we probably did about 15 interviews in one night from sources all over the country and the world. We did two interviews, one from Jamaica,
and
we proceeded to be on the cover of the Jamaican Times, and then one from Russia, which was Russia Today. And so it's been, yeah, just different people really interested, stuff that we would never have anticipated.
I think I learned out about it by looking at The Guardian, the national newspaper, The Guardian,
yeah.
And you were on the front page of that.
Yeah.
Well, how do you feel about it now, Kira?
I think that I'm as far as how we acted or how do I feel about the cause now?
Both.
I think that we reacted in a pretty positive way. I think that there's parts that I think are still unresolved. I would have liked our whole team or the team members of the team that continued to protest after we were uninvited, I think would have liked to be able to have an open conversation with the sheriff's department and those who opposed us, because I think that would have been a really constructive conversation. But I'm proud that we were able to stand up for what we believed in and got, for the most part, positive support. And going into it, we had wanted to raise awareness in our community, and I think at the very least we did that.
You certainly did. And just one last question. What about at the school? How do you feel that you basketball players, students, how do you feel you fit in now? Are things going okay? Are you getting support?
Yeah, we're definitely getting support. There's been our season started at this point, and both the girls' varsity and boys' varsity are both 6-1, so we're doing pretty well so far. And there's been definitely, I think, a larger amounts of community members coming this year to our games. There's been people that we saw at the protest that I don't think would have previously come to our games but have interest and want to support us in playing basketball now.
And have you heard the argument that there's no place for politics in sports?
Yeah, I have. And I think that that's, I mean, one of the more valid arguments perhaps that I've heard against us. But I think also that it's hard perhaps for some adults to realize that as a minor, we don't have that many opportunities to speak up and show that we're knowledgeable too about current issues in our country. And for us, the basketball court is the only place that I can think of where people come to watch us and listen to us. So it seemed to me to be the perfect place to get attention for what we were trying to say.
Okay, and good. And what's the rest of the season look like, Kara?
The rest of the season, we've got, Covelo is going to be our big opponent. That's the one loss we have.
Uh-huh.
And we lost by 2 points. It was like down to the last second. So we have a home game against them, and we have our other challenge will probably be Anderson Valley when we go play them away. So we play them next week, but we're confident that we're able to do it.
Well, very good luck for me. I guess I can say, being a coastal person myself, that there are lots of people behind you, so good luck, and lots of people behind you on this terrific story. Thanks, Kara.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Kira Pellman. Kira is the co-captain of the Mendocino Girls High School basketball team. And I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host this afternoon. Today, we're beginning a new series on KZYX, Mendocino Community Radio. It's a series in part honoring February, Black History Month, but we're calling the series Black Lives Matter, The Police and the People. Our next guest will be Tajiwe McHarris. Tajiwe is campaign director for Human Rights at Home, and she's been active in the movement protesting the killings of black people and raising the banner Black Lives Matter. Good afternoon, Tajiwe. It's great to have you here with us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure to be sure. I thought I'd just start with this. Some names: Oscar Grant, Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Akai Gurley. You're a human rights advocate. What do these names mean to you?
What they mean, it's a number of things, I think, at least to me, and I'm sure many people across the country. What they represent really is, you know, the fact that many people, many black people around the country are profiled, are targeted, are subject to police violence, police brutality, harassment, and excessive use of force. And in many of these cases, unfortunately, they lose their lives. And they also sort of represent the fact that there is a movement that's been growing in this country for some time now that has dedicated sort of itself to lifting up the names of those who have been killed by the police. Simply because of what they look like and the fact that this country has a history of criminalizing black people, brown people, poor people. And so that's what they represent to me. And, you know, as you sort of read the list, in my mind, you know, it just keeps going. You know, Chantel Davis, Kimani Gray, Ayanna Jones, and these names sort of, like, they don't end, really. And I think it just represents sort of why this movement is growing the way it is because there's a commitment that's been taken by people across the country who are determined to see an end to sort of that list growing.
And the movement itself, and I suppose your part in it, could you tell us a little bit about how what you see the movement as doing, what its important is, what you'd like it to achieve?
Sure. And at first, it's important to say that this movement has a history, and it goes without saying that this started decades ago before Ferguson. I think Ferguson, however, was a very powerful moment for this movement. It also was a pivotal moment to allow for the movement to grow. And that is because of, you know, young working class black people who when something happened, that tends to happen often, unfortunately, in our communities, a young person was killed by the police. They decided to do something about it, and they responded, in really courageous and beautiful ways, you know, and they protested and they resisted, and they did so sort of many times at the end of large weapons, including, you know, large machine guns, military tanks, in the midst of tear gas, which, you know, for people who've never been tear gassed before, you know, tear gas is sort of like a term that's sort of like it sort of softens what is really a really like a harmful and aggressive way of trying to destabilize someone. And they did that, and they continue to do that, and they continue to do that despite the amount of police violence and repression that they were met with. And that really, I think, inspired people across the country and also across the world. And now we see, whether it's Chicago or Boston or New York, we see people, you know, fighting fear, which is natural, and it's also common in our communities across the country. You know, something happens, and there's a history of fear, and I think that what you see is people sort of working through their fear and choosing to resist, and say everything from enough is enough to Black Lives Do Matter. And many times they are also met with, you know, with police and riot gear, and they're at the other end of a machine gun. Some pictures we see, some pictures we don't see. And so they've Ferguson really inspired a generation, but the nation is really inspired. It's, you know, people across the country have really inspired each other, and we see that continuing. And, you know, what I hope it achieves is to sort of to be uncompromising when it comes to what it is we need as a community, as sort of people across the country, in order to be able to live free of the kind of discrimination and the kind of violence that looks like Mike Brown's and looks like Ayanna Jones, and to continue to take action despite the fact that there is, you know, there continues to be ongoing repression, there continues to be violence, and that they continue going and advocating for an end to this violence on our communities, and that they also I also hope it accomplished sort of a recognition of just how powerful this generation is. I hope that there's a recognition collectively and also individually, every young person that decided to protest or decided to sort of fight past fear and continue to say what was important to them and to continue to fight for what mattered to them. That they know, you know, just how powerful they are, and that they understand that they're doing something important for the next generation coming, and they also know that this narrative that they are, that they're not effective, and this narrative that they are not, they're not sort of these sort of beautiful, like this beautiful mosaic of people across the country doing what's right, you know, for them and for others, you know, that they're able to sort of understand that all those things are not true. And what is true is this is an exceptionally powerful generation of young people who has showed the world sort of like what's possible when they decide that, you know, that it's that, you know, that they can, in fact, work towards putting an end towards this list growing.
Tenshiwa, you went to Ferguson, is that right?
Several times.
Could you tell us about that? And others went as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been in Ferguson, St. Louis many times. Since August 9th when Mike Brown was killed. And, you know, all I can say is that I don't think people who witnessed what many folks witnessed are able to sort of convey in words the depth of brutality that many of those young people faced. I had been in Egypt 2 months before I went to St. Louis, and the day before I was in Geneva with folks that were testifying around racial discrimination, and then I had went to St. Louis. But most of the contrast between sort of Egypt and St. Louis, and I've come to the U.S. And then to see, you know, large tanks going up and down the street, people, you know, tear gassing, shooting rounds of tear gas into groups of teenagers, sometimes young people younger than 13, 12, 11, 10 years old, to see that many machine guns pointed at young people who were doing nothing more than demanding justice. Many of them with their hands up, to witness that amount of fear is there's no words for it. And I think that what people need to know is there's been a lot of images that have come out of Ferguson, and people have shared stories. But I think what's important is even those images cannot convey how violent it was. And those images cannot convey how much fear existed. And there's no photo that could show the amount of brutality that was inflicted among the people in St. Louis. And I think it profoundly speaks to the need for this country to really address the fact that there's not just a history, but there's a current problem when it comes to discrimination against Black people, when it comes to the violence targeted against young Black people in this country.
And you've talked about a new generation, and you've used the word young people several times. And my old friend, Robin Kelly, suggested that I talk to you, and I know you're a modest person, but he said that in talking to you, I would be talking to an important representative of a whole new generation of activist leaders, not just about yourself, but is it possible for you to talk a little bit about who these people are, where they're coming from?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I can describe it. I think there's this idea that what we see happening across the country is just is not coordinated. And I think what we see happening across the country, one, it is spontaneous and it is organic, but there is a level of coordination that's happening. And there's no one leader. What there is there's leadership, you know, in various cities across this country who communicate and who talk to each other and who are inspired by each other's work. But then who also strategize together. And, you know, these are women, these are men, these are LGBTQ people. This is really like a mosaic of our community is sort of, you know, is helping lead this sort of national movement. And, you know, the leadership is also people in St. Louis and Ferguson who were the ones that initially inspired the country and inspired the world. And they're young. They're sort of, I don't know, it's hard to describe. It's almost like the most beautiful family anyone could be a part of when you think of sort of who that the leadership. Because, you know, there's a number of them, but there is no this sort of, you know, history of this one individual behind a pulpit, and usually a man, usually a straight man. That does not represent the leadership of this generation, you know. It's really a mosaic of people, and it also includes, you know, the fact that it also includes, you know, trans people. And I think many times as we talk about men who are losing their lives, we have to also make sure we're including women, but we also have to make sure that we also include trans people, trans women who are often violated, who are often criminalized, incarcerated, and many of them also lose their lives. You know, I go back to sort of what I said before. It's just like it's a beautiful family of people who love each other enough to keep fighting together despite sort of our geographical limitations of being far away from each other, or despite the fact that some of us have known each other for years and some of us, you know, maybe perhaps met in the past 6 months. But it's a group of people like committed to seeing another country for themselves, for each other, and for the next generation coming.
And the movement, you might say, it I guess it didn't just come to New York City, but it erupted in New York City at the end of last year, and you must have been seen all of that firsthand. Could you talk about the connection a little bit, and what was what was important or different or about New York, or was it the same?
Well, New York, you know, I think that what people you know understand this, but I think the no indictment around the Mike Brown decision happened, and it just happened, you know, and days later than the Eric Garner decision happened. And so, you know, emotionally, I think our communities across the country were feeling heavily impacted by, you know, a deep sense of injustice. And I think you know, what, because of, you know, what because of, you know, sort of the resistance in Ferguson, when there was a no indictment in St. Louis, people felt it across the country, including New York. And then for New York then to have to be impacted again by the Eric Garner decision, and then again, this is a man that many people watched die, you know, and he said, "I can't breathe," 11 times. And, you know, I think many of us call that a public lynching, you know. So to have watched that, to have just, you know, gone through the no indictment for the Mike Brown decision, I think it hit New York in a very incredible and difficult way. And I think we saw protests happen across the city. It's also important to know that New York has a long history of organizing against police violence. And so that, coupled with sort of this new, again, movement of young people who, you know, they don't need to have gone through a training in order to organize. And they don't need to have gone to a political education session to then show up to a protest. You know, we're at a point where the moment strikes and people come, and then we see, you know, sometime after, sort of one of the biggest, if not the biggest, anti-police violence, anti-racial discrimination protest, particularly around a death of someone who's in police custody, happened in New York City. I mean, I think the numbers going around is around 50,000 people at this point. And, you know, that was put together, I think, for a mobilization like that rather quickly. We're talking no resources, really. I mean, if any. And we're also talking about people, again, who are coming together because of a profound commitment to justice. And, you know, I think that's what we happen. And, you know, that's what we see happening. That's what we saw happen in New York. And what people also need to know is, like, it's not, you know, then we saw Reclaim MLK, which is another sort of moment where people organized across the country. But I think that the one thing that's important for people to take away is that it's not, you know, it's not over, you know, and people are going to continue to sort of stand for what's right and stand for justice and resist sort of having to live within a state or a country that your life doesn't matter, to the point where I will criminalize you, I will incarcerate you, and I will, you know, I will also kill you. And I think that we see not just protests and vigils, but we see various different forms of action, whether it's a teach-in or a workshop or a training or even just creating a healing space for people to go so that they can feel both safe to talk about their trauma around this issue, but they can also, you know, find an opportunity to connect with other people who are just now finding the words to say that they're afraid and they're hurting and they're scared. But they're also hopeful in the possibility that things could change.
And brave, I guess. The tactics that seem to have emerged of correct me, please, if I'm wrong, but kind of a direct action, disruptive, nonviolent tactic. What about that?
Well, I mean, I think it speaks to, again, this generation. It is all those things, nonviolent, but it is disruptive. And it's sort of like communicating. It's communicating a very powerful message, which is like the status quo has been for some time for the Black community and all oppressed communities who are the target of this kind of violence, but particularly the Black community, to be subject to this level of brutality and to normalize it. And the status quo is that it will continue. And I think that what we see happening is a commitment to disrupt that pattern, to disrupt status quo, but to also disrupt the pattern that of the sort of like every 28 hours, you know, a Black person is killed by the police or a vigilante. There, you know, MXGM, the Mock Suppression Movement, did a report on that. There is a commitment on behalf of this generation to disrupt that. You know, and I think that we see them doing it with highways, and we see them doing that with various other forms of actions. But what they're really saying is that this is no longer okay anymore. You know, And we're going to convey that in one way or the other. We're going to communicate that many times with our bodies or with our voices. And also just it shows how brave this generation is, because it's not easy. And there's a lot of fear that one must overcome in moments like this, especially when, you know, you have to normalize sort of police violence and harassment and surveillance in your life. And I think I'm always sort of there's never an event where someone, and many times a young person asks me, so what do I, like, I'm too scared to protest. And this is before sort of, you know, everything we've seen throughout 6 months is that there is a real legitimate fear within many people. And I think together, like, bounded by sort of like a deep sense of love for themselves and their community, we're watching people sort of resist that fear or work through that fear. And sort of the most brave, courageous, and creative and innovative ways. And the other thing is that they're inspiring each other. The cities are starting to inspire each other. Actions are inspiring each other. If you see sort of one dying, especially when it comes out of St. Louis, you see it across the country. And if you see a shutdown, so much that, you know, the young people have shut down a highway or an interstate, you start to see it replicated across the country. And that's what real leadership is, really. It's not a role, it's a style. And it also is the kind that inspires over and over again. And there's the life cycle never ends in terms of that kind of style. And I think this again, this generation is really, and I think, you know, I include myself as part of it. But I also, I can't help but seeing teenagers, you know, the young people. And I think that they are what inspires me, quite frankly. You know, or the 10-year, you know, the folks 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. I saw that in St. Louis, and I see it in New York, and I see it across the country. And, you know, it's, again, like, it's a leadership of the style. Their leadership inspires me.
Okay. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm Cal Winslow, your host today. Our program is Black Lives Matter, the Police and the People. And today we're talking to a New York City organizer, Tanjiwe McHarris, who works for human rights at home. We've been talking to her about the new movements. Tanjiwe, you said earlier that you'd recently been in Geneva and in Cairo, and that the movement was international. Perhaps you could fill us in on that for a minute or so.
Sure. You know, well, I think what's important to mention is that part of this movement is also committed to sort of holding the U.S. accountable at an international level. And so you see things happening at a local, state, and at a federal level, but also the international level, using various different opportunities to talk about what's happening in the country, to also just raise the names of Mike Brown and Eric Garner. And in this past November, the U.S. was being reviewed on its use of torture and cruel and unusual punishment. And the parents of Mike Brown went to Geneva to go testify about the death of their son, and so did organizers, but also, like, in protesters from St. Louis, from Ferguson, also went to testify, along with other young organizers out of Chicago and other places around the country, went to go testify at the UN in Geneva around police violence, around racial discrimination. And, you know, again, like, it just shows sort of, like, the level of, like, creativity and sophistication of this movement, of this generation. And, you know, it was a powerful time, you know, to see something like that happen. And also to see how, you know, Mike Brown's name was raised at the UN in Geneva, you know, by his parents and by protesters, by organizers. And then to have, you know, the UN committee, you know, ask the U.S. delegation directly, you know, around some of these cases, it's a very powerful experience. And I think that it's really only the beginning. You know, I think that there's a commitment on behalf of this movement and this generation to continue to go to the international level, to talk about what's happening in our communities. Again, because I think that there's a real commitment to see social transformation happening in the United States, and to see an end to all forms of discrimination, and to see an end to the targeting of Black people, to see a stop to the loss of Black life, and all lives, simply because of what they look like and because, you know, they, they're identified with being involved in criminal activity. And I think this was inspired by young Black people in Ferguson and St. Louis and what we see happening around the world when it comes to the movement around Black lives. And again, it's Geneva was very powerful, and it, you know, it's not going to stop. There's going to be more opportunities and times where this, you're going to see this movement, you know, go to hold the U.S. accountable at an international level.
Hmm. And the movement has sometimes been called a new civil rights movement in GUA. What would you say about that? Is that a fair, or are there differences or similarities? How do you feel?
I think it's a human rights movement, mm-hmm. quite frankly. I think if anything, civil rights law as it exists now is limiting. And I think that I see this sort of it's really, we can call it new, or we could just simply say it's an emerging sort of movement committed to realizing the rights of Black people in this country. You know, and in a lot of ways it has learned from history and from the movements of the past. And in some ways it's also defining its own path forward, which I think it needs to. Obviously, I think learning from our history is critical and it's important. But I think defining one's own path is just as important. And we're watching it. What we're seeing is tactics that one could say, particularly to the scale, is new, and it's of its own invention. Mm-hmm. And that is, again, like it's a reflection that this is a group of people, young people. And again, many of them learning from the past, but creating their own path, which I think is essential for the purposes of progress.
And you've talked a lot about young Black people. What about the others who joined with you, whites, Latinos? You mentioned LGBT people. How do you feel about their role in the movements?
Well, I think that, you know, in this, what's important is that everybody needs, I think that there's, everybody needs to talk about justice and needs to be part of a growing movement that's dedicated to transforming a country and a nation to becoming something different and something where we don't see people dying with their hands up or being killed simply because they were young and then they were Black. I think it's critical. It's also what makes this movement so important, so powerful, is that it represents and you know, there's people from across the country that are involved. And I think as we sort of elevate anti-Black racism, which is critical to sort of ending what we see happening in this country, I think what we also seeing is a powerful movement made up of sort of different communities working in solidarity with each other, especially when you think of the fact that there are, you know, of course, there are Black people dying in working class communities in the U.S., and there are also people dying on the border, whether it's the Arizona-Mexico border, they're being killed again by, you know, Border Patrol, or vigilante groups, and you know you see various different ways in which police violence, state repression has impacted communities across the country. And so the more and more we see sort of the similarities in terms of the suffering and the violence, you know, the better we are in terms of working in solidarity with each other. And I think we've seen the movement do that and grow as a result of it, while still sort of elevating a need to end or put an end to anti-Black racism.
Could I just ask you, if you don't mind, could you tell us, just for listeners would like to know, just a bit about yourself? Are you from New York? How did you get involved in this movement? What's Is that all right? Is that a good?
Yeah, of course. I am from the Bronx. So for anyone that sort of knows the Bronx is heavily, has been, is, and continues to be a heavily policed borough in New York City. And, you know, I went on to do racial justice work in New Orleans. I continue to do sort of growing as a social justice advocate, but really for me, understanding sort of the various different ways people in the U.S. are sort of, their rights are violated, but also like connecting that to around the world. And so part of my work has also been sort of understanding around the world how people are also subject to violence. And I think what's important to know is that, or to even just observe, is that the ways in which people are brutalized, you know, whether it's in the U.S. or Egypt, is starting to look more and more similar. And so the need to sort of like create sort of like this global movement for justice has never been more critical than it is right now. And, you know, I raise that every time I speak to people about this. If you look at around the world and you look at the ways in which people are violated and you see sort of like the techniques and you see the equipment being used and the different forms of technology, we're watching as it's become more and more similar. And so it's important on us as organizers, whether we're in Egypt or in the U.S. or Mexico, it's on us to sort of really to align ourselves, to work together, to create not just like a better countries for where we live, but really a better world.
Thank you very much. It's been interesting, inspiring, and I'm sure all of our listeners will join me in wishing you the best of luck and success. We've been talking with Dinjiwe Makaris. Thank you very much for being on the show, taking your time to help us. Our program today has been Black Lives Matter, the Police and the People. We've been talking with Kira Pellman of Mendocino and Dinjiwe Makaris of New York City. We've been talking about the new movement, Black Lives Matter. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. We'll be back next week here on KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio, back with part two of our series. Our guest will be Professor Alex Vitale. Professor Vitale is an associate professor of sociology at Brooklyn College at the City University of New York. He'll talk to us about police and policing based on his recent study of the New York City Police Department, City of Disorder. I hope you'll join me.